Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Russell, would you take us through, like, we're probably going to have time for each of you to hit one. So we've had Boyd's, which was Zion, and he kind of talked about the materialism and stuff. What's another area of Hugh's broader social critique that has struck you, caught your attention, and what would be good sources to point our listeners to?
Well, I mean, I am in Boyd's camp. I mean, it's the discussion of Zion and the idea of trying to figure out what kind of community we are called to build, what kind of relationships, social, economic, political, and so forth, we should have within those communities. Those are the things that really occupy me. I recognize that Nibley is a powerful pacifist voice, that he is a powerful voice in terms of his critique of organizations. I recognize that he has enormous amounts of stuff, a lot of it very, very funny, in regards to our culture, our art, our music. Our
we'll definitely go after all that stuff.
No, I mean, I'm a political theorist. Look, the best way for it to be communicated is to throw out a couple of quotes. And okay. So bear with me while I just read a couple of short passages here. So let's try, for instance, from Deny Not the Gifts of God, which is on page 14. This is a passage on page 145 within the Farms volume, Approaching Zion. What are we instructed to do, then, in our fallen state? One of the shortest and most concise sections of the Doctrine and Covenants tells us, let your time be devoted to the studying of the Scriptures and to preaching and to confirming the church and to performing your labors on the land. The great triple combination, farming, church, and study. Even so, Adam was told to cultivate his garden, preach the gospel among his children, a most strenuous mission, and finally to seek ever greater light and knowledge. Let me remind you that this system has worked throughout the ages whenever it has been given a try. What is the result of our industrial military complex, which seems to be the inevitable trend of every greedy industrial society? It has never worked. Not for one decade has it failed to fill the earth with blood and horror. Where has it brought us at the present moment? Hear the words of Henry C. Wallach, the governor of the Federal Reserve, as he describes our society in which the economy is all in all. It is a form of fraud perpetrated by everybody on everybody. It is a world in which nobody keeps his word. Even if you could adjust perfectly for it, it would be a very unpleasant world. So here you have an argument against financial and economic complex,
industrial military,
Well, you know, the industrial military complex, yes, but I mean, what he's really getting at here is the complicatedness, the distractions of this society, the fact that everybody is obliged to buy in to this idea of gain and thereby channeling themselves in increasingly narrow paths that set them in conflict with one another. The alternative to this is to do something that is always available as a renewable gift. The land is there. The church is there. Knowledge, study, scholarship is always there. Now, is it possible to actually build up a sustainable society on that basis? Some would say yes, some would say no. Nibley himself doesn't say, because he's confident that God will take care of those that attempt to live this way. Those of us that want to study out that critique might have to ask the ensuing questions. But I mean, this is something that's really at the heart of his argument. One other passage. Let's do one from Work We Must, But the Lunch is Free. This is on pages 229 over to 230 out of the same Approaching Zion volume. The issue of independence is charged with a special emotional impact for Americans. The word has become a fetish for the Latter-day Saints and led them into endless financial speculations and plans. They that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, says Paul, all of which the Lord has strictly forbidden. In the scriptures, the word independent occurs only once, describing the church with no reference to any individual. The church may stand independent above all other creatures because it is entirely dependent upon my providence, quoting there from the Doctrine and Covenants. It is dependence that is important for King Benjamin, total dependence upon God. And if you serve him with your whole heart and your whole soul, you are free from dependence on any other being. In the law of Moses, the Lord's release cancels all indebtedness of man, while God transfers his claims on our indebtedness to the poor. It is through them that he asks us to pay our debt to him. Let us refer back for the moment to Satan's plan for independence. When following Satan's instructions, Cain murdered his brother Abel for the sake of getting gain. He declared his independence, and Cain gloried in that which he had done, saying, "I am free. Surely the flocks of my brother falleth into my hands." Recently, this gospel was proclaimed by one of the richest Americans addressing the student body of Ohio State University. "There is nothing that gives freedom," he said, "like bucks in the bank." This seems to be the policy we are following today. And there is no doubt whose policy it is. A critique there of individualism, of financial and economic individualism. This idea of getting gain, piling up wealth, accumulating property for the sake of being able to stand independent is, from Nibley's point of view, false. It is in opposition to the Zion ideal, where independence only comes as a gift from God when we turn to our fellow man, turn to the poor, and share of our goods with them. That is the sort of independence that the church will have collectively as a community. It's not something where you are to stand alone. So again, you know, a very, very incisive argument against our economic and social presumptions are packed right into this description of Zion here. This is the stuff that really obsesses me. And I recognize that there's a lot of Nibley that I don't pay as much attention to because I'm trying to figure out what, if anything, we can do with his model of Zion, a model that I think is frankly anti-capitalist, a model that I think is deeply communitarian, a model that I think is actually somewhat localist and agrarian and actually points us towards a less wealthy, less technological, much simpler society. Can I substantiate all those claims on the basis of Nibley's comments? Not really, but it's the best I can do to try to make sense of this vision of Zion that he had and that he constantly used as a basis to challenge, to goad, to not attack, but to reprove, let's say, right, the Mormon society that he saw around him.
Right, and the wider society as well.
Well, I think he cared about the wider society, but maybe not as much as the people that were reading the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants along with him. He thought that they needed to be doing better than they
okay.
were.
Okay, nice. Randy, what's another area of wider social critique, and then we'll absolutely come right into the wheelhouse of the critique of Mormonism.
Okay, I just want to let me riff for just a second on what Russell said. I think the idea of being independently wealthy is, for Hugh Nibley, was something that he was trying to deeply critique. The idea of being wealthy, he that hath eternal life is rich. For him, whatever that was, it seemed to be something that had to do with feeling of loving families, friends, the idea of a social Zion, of enjoying yourself. That was wealth. With the arts, as I said, and those kinds of things, that was wealth. And certainly, wealth, therefore, was tied to interdependence, if you will, of relationships. And so the idea of being independent and wealthy was a kind of an oxymoron for him. But let's go on now to, and that, by the way, that's also affected my life deeply. when I, in my business career, and to this day, when I get up mornings feeling like that pit in my stomach that I'm not going to be able to take care of my wife in my waning years, that, you know, we won't have enough, it does help to go back to a Nibley-esque moment and realize, you know, just do your part. You don't have to get out of this life rich. You don't have to have an estate. You don't have to do anything except, as Nibley would say, forgive and repent. And that's all you can do that's going to last. And he just was the first person that got me to think that way, and he still is someone who is kind of the last person that comes back to my mind. So I just wanted to throw a shout out to Hugh Nibley, who's helpful in my own life as a corrective of my fear that, and I would push back a little bit on, and we'll talk maybe later with Ruffel. I don't think he would have gone so far as to say he's a critic of capitalism or any ism. He's a critic of the way we do capitalism or any other ism, but we'll go in that in a minute. I wanted to talk about one of my favorite essays of his that affected me was The Rise of Rhetoric and the Decline of Everything Else. The whole idea of human communication being and the whole culture based on influencing people for personal gain and therefore not telling complete truth of semi-honest communication. He would talk about this both in the academic world, in the business world, in the religious world, and I have been deeply affected by this whole question in that essay of what my motives are and what people's motives are as being kind of the prime question before anything else goes on. If someone is approaching me for any reason, whether it's a commercial ad or whether it's my friends or children or whatever, my first tendency is to say, what motives are involved here? And can I trust them? Nibley was able, I think, to take us with that essay to realize why the love of Christ is the only ultimate motive you can trust. Everything else can be somehow corrupted. But whatever this thing is that God gives us that is a revelation of love is something that will correct all rhetoric. It will correct, it will protect you from an attack of someone who's trying to lie to you. It will also protect you when you are trying to communicate to other people and you feel befuddled in yourself. Go to that point in yourself where you pray for the highest motive of love to rise in you, and then you will have utterance. Then whatever you say or do will be received in the right way. I just wanted to say one more thing, which is Wayne Booth, who is also someone who's influenced me deeply and died a few years ago, great literary critic and writer at the University of Chicago, and a Mormon, and he's buried up on the Alpine Cemetery Hill, said that we need to bring back rhetoric in its original sense. So that was another area where I think Hugh Nibley would have enjoyed, I think, being corrected by Wayne Booth or getting into a discussion with him to say that we are in a world where, at least in the postmodern time, where the very idea of having persuasive speech is kind of all we have. We're not trying to get to fundamentals anymore. We're trying to get to the most persuasive speech or the speech that makes a difference to us somehow. And Nibley would have said, I think, in response to that the only talent, because he used rhetoric all the time in his speeches. I mean, he was, in his own way, he had a great style. He would have said, okay, there's nothing wrong with being a great public speaker or using rhetorical persuasion as long as your motive of love is clear to you and to the hearer. So I'll leave that I'll leave that comment there. I wasn't trying to, and I think Nibley wouldn't be trashing rhetoric. He was saying that, oh, we say now today it's mere rhetoric, meaning sophistry, meaning obfuscating comments that try to make unclear something for the benefit of the speaker, not for the benefit of the hearer.
Nice. And enough
of that.
Yeah,
that affected me greatly.
Yeah, yeah. And for those who are keeping score, that one is found in Volume 10 of the Collected Works series, the volume called An Ancient State, or The Ancient State. So thank you, Randy, very much. All right, guys, I want to move more to the specific Mormon culture stuff, but there's just a couple areas I want to name, and perhaps you guys can come up with a source. So we mentioned that Hugh's an avid environmentalist. In the biographical section of this podcast, we definitely talked about his love of nature, the outdoors, his growth growing up in Oregon, and how that was a lifelong thing. Boyd, where would at least be some possible places that people might want to read a key essay or two on that?
Man's Dominion or Subduing the Earth is a classic essay, and that was actually quoted by one of my favorite social critics, Wendell Berry, the farmer poet.
I thought of him when Russell was talking about the agrarian Hugh Nibley.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And that's the first volume. That's the first essay in the collection called Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints.
Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints. Yeah, that's
terrific.
A classic essay. Hugh actually met Wendell Berry when Wendell was on campus, and so I wrote to Wendell Berry and asked him about that and why he ended up using that essay. And I got this wonderful handwritten, Wendell Berry.
Yeah, he never used a computer. Yep.
Wouldn't use a computer. Handwritten letter back from Wendell Berry telling me that, he used it because he thought Hugh Nibley's words were exactly right. He said he had a really warm recollection of meeting with the man. And he said that essay, was just well said and stated exactly right. And so that was really a classic essay, and I think that goes a long ways to creating a kind of Mormon ethic for environmental stewardship. His Brigham Young and the Environment, also in that compilation, Stewardship of the Air. Promised Lands is one of my favorite pieces because he talks about his experience visiting the Hopi and kind of uses that as a way of thinking about environmentalism and land stewardship.
Perfect, yeah.
Whole bunch of really fine essays in it, but if there's any place to start, it would be Subduing the Earth or Man's Dominion. So that was actually an essay published in the Ensign, if I'm not mistaken. Here's an Ensign publication that was going for environmental stewardship.
Sweet, cool. Okay, so environmentalism, a big piece. Just another general area would be the war stuff. We kind of mentioned a little bit about the military-industrial complex. What would be some sources, guys, for anybody who wants to quickly look at an essay or two on war?
Again, in Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints, there's several essays. There was an essay that it's really kind of a fascinating story. Hugh was on campus in the 1960s during the Vietnam protests, but at BYU they were pro-Vietnam protests, and campus hosted a screening of a film, No Substitute for Victory, was what the title of the film was. It was a documentary, and Ezra Taft Benson appeared in it in his role as Secretary of Agriculture in the Eisenhower administration. And so it premiered. One of its premieres was at the BYU campus. And just a couple of days after that premiere, Hugh Nibley had a letter to the editor, a very long letter to the editor in the student paper, called Renounce War or A Substitute for Victory.
Oh, nice.
That really classic essay. And then there was another piece. This was published in the Ensign, or this one I think was in the New Era, called If There Must Needs Be a Fence. So that was published, at that same time period. It seems strange today to think of, anti-war pieces appearing in church publications, but
Hugh got them in.
J. Reuben Clark was very much in that same camp, and I think he had a big say in Hugh getting those essays placed where he did. But
Boyd, let me add one of my favorites, which is Warfare in the Book of Mormon, where Nibley was definitely using General Moroni in a, pardon my pun, as a double-edged sword where he was saying, effectively, Moroni hated war, and he was only reluctantly brought in as a warrior. And when he engaged, especially in what he called stratagem in the Book of Mormon, he did it with complete apology. He just felt horrible about it. You could tell he wasn't triumphantly victorious here. He was being pragmatic, and the other thing Nibley did about said, don't skip reading the last sections of Alma. What is it? A third of Book of Alma is all about war. He said it's there for a purpose. One, to show us how horrible war is, and to show us that even with the gospel, you can be entrenched in war in ways that you shouldn't be, and to tell us in our own generation that this is going to be a theme for our time, and that we've got to be prepared to not go at war in a jingoistic way, but think about it the way the gospel teaches us to think about it. And Nibley, therefore, was always pushing for us to not go with one way of thinking about anything. It wasn't that he was confused, but that he always wanted to diffuse the political power at whoever was using it right now to get people to stop thinking and especially stop feeling the spirit in their lives that would say there's another way. And
thank you. Yeah. Russell, do you have anything? Do you want to contribute an essay on war?
Only that, going along with what Randy was saying, there's several times where, as Nibley lays out, these ideas and these arguments, and I think particularly in his essay Freeman and Kingman in the Book of Mormon, Nibley makes it clear that he feels so much of this is driven by larger interests. It's driven, by conspiring men, desiring power. It's driven by factions that he thinks are ultimately satanic, that he thinks are anti-Christian and anti-Zion. And that's not to say that, that Nibley was some sort of, conspiracy thinker who assumed that, every kind of, instance of war is something that's been foisted upon the people by an Illuminati. But he was not dismissive of that possibility either. He really did genuinely believe, or at least it seems to me on the basis of several of his essays, that he finds that he really did genuinely believe that often the people are being misled, that people are being manipulated, that the passion for war, the bloodthirst that people get riled up to. He didn't often seem to, or at least in my reading, it seemed as though he didn't often blame them, but he blamed, these forces at work in people's lives to delude them. False traditions of the fathers and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Propagated by those who benefit from such false traditions. So
yeah, I would.
There's a way in which I see that a lot of his comments on war being, of a piece with, some of the more radical thinkers out there, the Noam Chomskys and others who, really suggest that a lot of our blood-soaked world is the way it is because there are those that profit from it. And there are organizations and countries that profit from it, and they mislead and perpetuate that which misleads for the sake of wrapping themselves in the popular acclaim of the people to, to defend themselves against this or that threat. But it's all false. It's all a game perpetrated by those that benefit from such games. So, I mean, that would be an additional thing that I think is present in his anti-war writings.
I agree, Russell. I think one of his great lines, I can't remember the essay, but he said, the great secret taught from the beginning, the secret of Master Mahan, was that you can murder for gain. And for him, I remember one of his essays, he said, he was talking about war, and just what you described, that for gain, people engage in war and are willing to murder or kill for the gain they get, power and wealth. But then he said, and he flipped to another switch when he said, and I remember in my youth going up to the trees in Oregon and seeing them being murdered by the logging industry just for gain. In other words, he would take this idea to the economic limit also and feel like to kill animals and large trees. I don't know what he would have felt about small plants. there was definitely that thing in him from a young age that we destroy for gain, and that mm-hmm. is the devil's way. That is the devil's way.
And Randy, we also talked about that in the biographical one, and the logging that was being done where he's saying those things was being done by his grandfather, Charles W. Nibley, and his company.
Yes.
So, yes. You know, so Hugh is nobody's spared from the critique.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
and
right.
A member
that's
of the right. First Presidency.
Right.
Anyway, so interesting. Well, thanks, guys. I want to turn to ourselves. I know you guys don't have a whole lot more time to give me here, but I want to let's all hit out our favorite Nibleyisms when it comes to Mormon culture. We just need to go, go, go. So whoever's got quotes ready, Boyd, you mentioned one of your favorites is from Leaders to Managers, The Fatal Shift. What's some ideas there that he picks on?
Well, that essay is the one where he reflects on his speech years earlier, where uh-huh. he gave the prayer in the commencement exercise, where he said, "You know, we've met here in the robes of the false priesthood," and then he goes on and
doesn't he also say to heap upon ourselves the honors of men?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, I always love that second part, too. Here we are, to Father, clothed in the robes of a false priesthood, to heed upon our... So he's just critiquing right there in the prayer. It's just so
There's
awesome.
There's video of that, too, which is just wonderful, because you can see the people up on the dais in back of him as he's delivering this lecture, and it includes all these dignified authorities and church leaders and they're just kind of shocked as he's giving the speech. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, it was that essay where I first realized, because, you know, I got a master's and a PhD. It was in that essay that I first really realized what these hoods are. You know,
yeah.
And it's monastery, you know, it throws all the back to, you know, that was the preserver of intellectual traditions and things. And, you know, all the early universities were theology schools and whatnot. And they only specialized later. So, you know, Hugh just not only the critique of like, hey, isn't this funny? Like, we need to shine a light on it. But, you know, he's just reminding us that everything in this world has a history. It's got a dialogue, and it's important to remind ourselves of that.
Yeah, but I think the best part of that talk is when he goes on and critiques, you know, the Utah Valley kind of Mormon culture and he talks about how we value things that are not very valuable, and we, as he put it, we treasure our trash and trash our treasures. You know, he really it's a really strident critique of the way we don't value the things we should value. And we value, and the main focus here is that we value management, but we don't value leadership. And leadership is what we need, and not management. It's a classic talk.
Oh, it is. And again, it's also in the Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints volume, which is number 13 in the collected works.
I'd add, the nice thing is that all of these are available online, too. The Maxwell Institute has the collected works up there. And the
nice.
Religious Studies Center has Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless online, so you can read that for free. So,
and that's a collection of sort of his social stuff too. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's got a variety of all kinds of things there.
Awesome.
Let me just throw this out. I have Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless in front of me. I bought this as a freshman at BYU back in 1987, and one of the things that has always stayed with me is that the Religious Studies Center invited Hugh to write these prefaces to each of the essays that were included inside the book Timely and Timeless. And the prefaces are so delightfully mean and sharp and funny. So, like, for instance, if we're talking about the stuff where he really, you know, takes a shot at Utah, BYU, Mormon, Zuby culture. Well, I can't do better than the preface that he wrote introducing his essay, Zeal Without Knowledge. He writes here, "This talk was given on request as part of the celebration of Academic Emphasis Week. Once a year, for a whole week, our students are free to turn their minds to things of an intellectual nature without shame or embarrassment. After this cerebral Saturnalia, the young people mostly return to their normal patterns, concealing the neglect of hard scholarship by the claim to spirituality and strict standards of dress and grooming. Yet, from time to time, a student will confess to wayward twinges of thought and find himself wondering, if the glory of God is intelligence, our school motto, might there not be some possible connection between intelligence and spirituality? Under temporary license from the Academics Committee, we have now presumed to touch on this sensitive theme."
Oh. That is so vicious.
Zeal without knowledge is so great. I mean, it's just, I mean, he stands up there and he just takes apart the idea that there are people all around him who are feeling confident in their own standing before God because they're in good shape as far as the Honor Code office is concerned. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So, you know, that's a great one. Yeah. Everyone should read that one.
Well, or even let's just riff a little bit more. Or they're in good standing before God because they're willing to get up at 6 a.m. to attend meetings or to do all these external things and missing the bigger point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is the essay, folks, where if you think you're bored in church, he critiques how boring church has become and the reasons for it. Let's see, what are some of the other things in Zeal Without Knowledge? It's just it is just an amazing thing. What is it? We'd rather get up early and write a bad book than sleep in until 9 or 10 and write a good one. I should have relooked at it, but it's also in Approaching Zion, that volume. Anybody else with a favorite? Randy, I want to do this. I know you've got to leave pretty quick. Would you give me any other favorite, like, skewerings, ironies, you know, whatever, you know, Hewitt is best in his satirical flavor, but, you know, really a dead-on thing. And then also, I know you, did you have a critique of Nibley that you wanted to share with us today, at least in a deeper manner than you had earlier?
It would only fit if you cut it back to that section on business, where I said he was, from my point of view, of course, which is always, this is a critique of my critique, he was blind to see how much intellectual rigor and excitement and joy you could have in a good business deal. He seemed to, with his critique, at times take down a whole establishment, whereas when I talked with him about one of his sons, he told me he was very proud of the accomplishment he had made in some business transaction that was well executed. And so I knew that he publicly had been seen by most of the business community as someone who just was so insufferably critical and impractical in his thought that he should be disregarded. That I was sad about, because I think Hugh's rhetoric could have been a little bit more clever. Here I am trying to criticize Hugh Nibley's rhetoric, but I'll do it, forgive me, Hugh, in approaching in a more influential way those who could have heard him in the business community had he somehow sympathetically gone into and understood the intellectual rigor and the delightful art involved in not stealing money from people, but in practically doing something together in a partnership that would benefit the whole world. You see what I'm getting at?
Yes, absolutely.
And so that was the one area where I really think I wish he had gone a little farther, maybe had more experience with business people, to have seen a way of talking to that section of the Mormon community that still doesn't get Nibley. They don't listen. They think he's too harsh on them.
Yeah.
And it's the critique that their critique of Zion is real, and I grant that it is part of American culture that's a deep problem, and Mormon culture that's a deep problem, that we tend to look down on our brothers and sisters who don't, you know, don't have wealth. But I'm not trying to say that shouldn't be there. But if you can insert that critique someplace in there, that might be useful.
Okay. Or I think it's fine even here. So we know that we're winding down. So do you have a favorite skewer? Or I want to also give Russell a chance to talk about a favorite one more, and then we'll close.
Why don't you go to Russell, and I'll think between the two or three that I've got on my mind.
Okay. Russell, do you have one handy?
Well, let's see. I mean, I've already mentioned some of my favorites. I'm sure there are others that we could go into. Hugh Nibley was interviewed once by Student Review when I worked for it, and I doubt that that is transcribed and collected anywhere, though maybe it is. I don't know. One of the things that he did in that interview, and this kind of picks up on some of the things Randy was talking about, is that Nibley really let his anti-lawyer animus come out in that interview after he was asked a question about the then new administration at Brigham Young University with Rex Lee. And Nibley's comment was something along the lines of, "We're surrounded by lawyers now," or something. he frequently, speaks in a highly critical way about lawyers and law in general. I think that there is a deep point to that, which tracks back to the things that we've discussed already about his emphasis upon gifts and his emphasis upon the idea that independence is only achieved through, a sharing and a trusting within community. And, of course, an adversarial kind of property-minded legal system works against that. But I also think just in general, he might not have liked lawyers because of just particular encounters he may have had with them. I don't know if there's any substance to that, but it certainly came through in some comments of his.
He would use the lawyers in the Book of Mormon as the bad guys, the Ezraim, they were the lawyers, right? They're always the ones that the devil was getting somehow. They were easy prey for the diabolical side. I think there was also that side of legalism again for him, where anybody would live a rule or follow a law for the sake of the law itself. Again, that was a good of second intent, not a first intent, and it would always bug him when people were doing things for sheer obedience. His idea that obedience was a virtue was always subtly critiqued. You know, you could obey the devil, or you could obey God. Both were strict obedience, right? And so he wanted to get to the heart of things, and would try to get there. I think, in a way that would shock you a little bit if you listened to him. His method was to create a personal shock. It would get you to think for a moment in a different way, and I'm trying to come up with a final statement that would be useful for you, Nibley, from my life, and I'm having a hard time doing it other than to say he certainly was someone who, as a person, stood out in a community as a kind of iconoclast. And it wasn't just his erudition, but we've talked about it, and I'm sure you've talked about it in the past podcasts. His very personality, the way he carried himself, was unique. And that we could have more unique people in Mormonism is something that I would crave to be part of our future. That instead of homogenizing the church in any mode, whether it's late 20th century businessmen in ties, or whether it's, I don't know what the 21st century holds, what new stereotype is in danger of coming down the pike, But what Hugh Nibley should remind us all of is that we are all unique gifts that we can bring into the world, and we should resist our Mormon culture as culture. It's a culture that invites us to resist it, not to resist the community, but to resist the homogenizing of being a member of the community in one way. I think I'd like to leave with this idea that Nibley once said in my hearing that one of the most unselfish things that humans do is to get up early in the morning and go up to the temple and do vicarious work for dead people. He found that somehow strange in a pragmatic modern world, and delightfully strange. I think of that all the time, of his resistance to the mere pragmatic and wanting to be something that other people see as strange. He loved Enoch. One of his essays on Enoch was called, I think, Strange Things Strangely Told. That idea of a wild man, Enoch, being, and maybe we're ending on the theme of the fool. Nibley is a wild man. Mormons is wild men and women.
Awesome.
in their own way. Not fitting in, but not being angry either. Not being angry critics, but still not fitting in. Don't fit into Mormonism. Don't fit into the world. If you do, you've already sold out somehow.
Awesome.
That's definitely kind of message.
Randy, thank you so much. I know you got to go, so I'll just let you drop off. Thanks for being on the call, brother.
Thank you, brothers.
It's a pleasure
nice
to be from
with
you, Randy.
You, Russell. And great to be with great to be with you too, Boyd. Thanks, fellas, very much for letting me on board today. See you later.
See ya. Russell, I'll let you close with a final, either favorite or just some closing thoughts. And then, Boyd, I'm going to keep you on just for a few minutes longer for a close.
I mentioned at the beginning of my comments that my father had read Approaching Zion. My father is, you know, a pretty typical conservative American Mormon. You know, never been a terrible ideologue. There was a point in his life where he was, you know, reading lots of W. Cleon Skousen, and he felt like he needed to buy some, like, gold and silver ingots and hide them down in the basement in preparation for the end times. But I think that was, you know, just a small moment in a history of, you know, being, you know, just your typical Western American white Mormon Republican. And he wrote Approaching Zion. And it really got to him for a while. There was an effort led by my father for us as a family to do some things differently. My father ran a business that several of my brothers were employees at. My dad began talking about trying to create some sort of family, you know, consecration operation. We're going to all contribute to this general fund, and we would all own stock in the business, and it would be shared equally amongst us. And we would have kind of a Fox Family Zion. You know, did it ever really take off? Not as much as I wish it had. It was certainly a learning experience in many ways. You know, the 2 or 3 years, maybe it was a little longer than that, maybe 3 or 4 years, while the family, you know, really strove to implement consecration ideas within the family business. I attribute my father's willingness to take such a chance to Hugh Nibley. He told me that he'd had an opportunity once to talk with his former mission president, Marion D. Hanks, you know, back when Marion D. Hanks was, you know, in a position to be able to talk with people. And as my father related it to me, he asked Elder Hanks what the general authorities thought of Hugh Nibley. And according to him, Elder Hanks said, "Hugh Nibley, well, he's out there." And my father told me he didn't know if he wanted to take that as a critique or as an expression of admiration that Nibley had gotten so far out there and had kind of staked his claim someplace where we all ought to get. I got to give a tribute to my dad for being willing as a businessman and an entrepreneur to try to figure out how he might be able to bring Nibley's message into his life. And even if he was unsuccessful, well, the fact of the matter is that the church was unsuccessful, weren't we? You know, in Missouri and again in Nauvoo and again in Utah, we've been unsuccessful in all of our efforts to implement consecration and build Zion. But we keep trying, or at least we're supposed to keep trying. And Nibley was there to remind us to keep trying in my own way. I'm not a businessman, but I try to live my life in certain ways. I try to maintain a certain level of conservation and economic conservatism, not, you know, in the, you know, liberal capitalist sense, but in the real sense of, you know, trying to be, you know, a responsible conserver of my gifts so that I can share them with others. There's been a lot of reasons why I pursue that path, but Nibley's one of those reasons. So he's there as a prophetic call to many of us in many different ways. He's there as a source of laughter, a source of inspiration, sometimes a source of embarrassment and shame and hopefully rethinking and doing better. He was a gift to all of us. And I'm just grateful that there are people like Boyd that have done so much work to make sure that his message stays available to us and is there to goad us and inspire us and guide us in many, many ways. So thank you for giving me a chance to talk about you, Nibley.
Can't imagine this discussion without you. Thank you. You were just a wonderful choice. So Boyd, thanks for thinking of Russell.
Yeah, it was perfect, wasn't it? I knew he'd be great.
I appreciate you guys. All right.
All right. Thank you, brother, and we'll talk soon, but really appreciate you being on the call.
No problem.
Take care. Goodbye. Boyd, I just want to close with you a little bit. I want to give you a shot at it, but let me steer for a second. I kind of began the theme of, you know, the prophet, Hugh as the prophet, and there was a piece of the Orson Scott Card essay about Gene England that I thought was really, really important, and I think it's important for this kind of podcast and the audience that listens to it. And one of the things was that, you know, even though we talk about the prophets sort of being on the outside in terms of, you know, they're not part of the hierarchy, they're not part of the those who are charged to keep the status quo, one of the most important things about prophets to be effective and why he thought that both Nibley and Eugene England fit this role was that they were clearly part of the community. And Russell was even talking about there. There's zero doubt that Gene England or Hugh Nibley were not committed to the faith, that they didn't have this community's best interest. So even as they looked and saw past the culture and critiqued it left and right, there was never a sense with Hugh, for instance, that he wasn't loyal. Would you just riff on that, or is that a good fit for you, that why he's an effective voice? And so perhaps some of us who are maybe more inclined to critique Mormon culture from academic standards or from things that, you know, we learn outside of us, unless we can ground it within the tradition itself, and unless our feet are on the ground and our tires are, you know, truly on the road within this community, it's going to be harder for us to be heard, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. You know, several people asked me as I was writing the biography, you know, how Hugh got away with it. Because he is very strident in some of his criticisms. And it would be very easy for somebody to misunderstand and think he was criticizing, you know, the church as an institution. And I think the reason he got away with it is that his loyalty was so pronounced. He really stressed his loyalty. And in fact, when he critiqued the church, he used Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and general authorities and you know, other prophetic voices to critique the culture. Gene England has a wonderful essay where Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, where he talks about the church being in a similar way to a marriage, that it's a relational thing, that you have this relationship with the church. And I read a book years ago about Why Marriages Succeed and Fail by a guy named John Gottman, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a really useful essay about marriage, but one of the insightful things that I found from that book is that he said that they can predict with a large degree of accuracy whether a marriage is going to fail or succeed based on one issue, and that is the ratio of positive to negative things that happen in that relationship. And it has to be about 5 to 1, 5 positive to 1 negative. And, you know, I think if we kind of take that and think about it in terms of Hugh with his critiques of Mormon culture, and, you know, he was so pronounced on his loyalty. He was such an ardent defender of the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants, and especially the Book of Abraham, Book of Moses. And he was so faithful about going to church and doing his callings. You know, I don't think he ever missed a home teaching appointment. He was very faithful about that kind of thing, which is, you know, it puts me to shame. but I think his commitment was so pronounced that he could get away with those critical points because people recognized and general authorities recognized that he wasn't criticizing the church. He was criticizing the culture, that he's criticizing what's going on and the problems that we have as a culture. And so I think that's a very important point that he really set a great example that way.
Well, thanks for being on again, my friend. You've been, I bet we're seven and a half hours by the time.
Yeah, we've got this is,
but is there any final Hugh Nibley thought that you want to leave people with?
Randy talked a little bit about how Hugh was so critical of business that he didn't let, you know, he used language that business people couldn't understand. And I think this comes from another issue that we didn't really talk about so much in this episode, but we did in the first episode, and that is that a lot of this social criticism does come from instances that happened in his own life. So his critique of business was very much influenced by his father's really shady business practices. And I found some really depressing letters when I was going through correspondence that, you know, from widows who had written to him telling him about how his father had convinced them, based on his good name, that they should invest in this shady business deal. And, you know, Hugh was a college professor trying to raise a family of 8, and I know he would have loved to have helped all these people recover their money, but he couldn't do anything, and he felt horrible about it. And so, you know, there were a lot of instances where his father's business dealings were so awful that I think that really influenced his attitude. Now, not that he wasn't anti-materialistic before that, because he tells stories about how as a 5-year-old boy, he got 5 shiny pennies, and he remembers dropping them into the river saying, oh, what's the point? This is all just dross, you know?
Oh, wow. So quoting Ecclesiastes and Things at 5.
It's very, very philosophical at a very early age. You know, he had a very close relationship with nature, and then he saw his uncle's company cutting it down, and I think that had a huge impact on his attitudes about the environment. And his attitudes about war, even though they were set before he was in World War II, you know, his background in World War II really convinced him that it was a despicable, horrible, awful thing, you know, and he just had no patience for it after that and became a very vocal anti-war protester.
But, of course, having Section 98 to draw on and all these other things in the Book of Mormon and things as well. So it wasn't, so it wasn't just willy-nilly like I had a bad experience. Yeah.
No, he came to his... He came to his positions through both experience and homework.
You know,
they were both experiential and theoretical based, and so he was a very unique person that way. I think he was somebody who really saw the big picture of both. You know, Randy talks about the sense of impracticality, but in some ways Nibley was very practical. I mean, I think one of the reasons he supported a lot of Democratic politics was that he felt like, you know, there's no other way that these laws of consecration are going to get implemented, that social justice is going to get implemented if we don't support things that promote social justice. And so he tended to vote Democrat. Again, though, he was very, a very unique person. He was in a lot of ways, anti-party, party man in that sense. But, you know, I think the final thing I'd say is that I think his social criticism is thought-provoking, but he did leave the specifics to individuals. He was not a specifics person. He didn't. I never sensed that he judged people based on how they ran their lives, but he always respected different people's attempts to implement, you know, the gospel in their lives. And, you know, even though in a lot of ways the church wasn't changed institutionally in terms of social criticism, I talked to a number of people who talked about how his environmental essays had changed the way they lived their lives. It made them appreciate the natural world more, take, you know, steps to protect it, how one woman talked about how after reading Approaching Zion, she cut back her hours on work to spend more time with her kids. Another person I talked with talked about how they actually sold their home and bought a smaller, starter home because they really didn't need the space and to donate that money to better causes. I've talked to several people who've had career changes because they felt like, you know, they were doing things that were promoting goods of the second intent, not the first intent, but they were spending time on things that really mattered to them and to their lives. And so, you know, a lot of people, I think he influenced a lot of individual lives in very profound ways. And, you know, I hope he continues to do so, because I think that's the hugest contribution he made to Mormon thought, was just this sense of, you know, the bigness of the gospel and the ways it can apply to our individual lives. It's quite powerful stuff.
Loved it. Thank you, my friend. Hey, let me close with something that ties into the title of your book, and it which is, you know, Hugh Nibley, A Consecrated Life. And it's just a line that I found in this Scott Card review. He's talking about England, but let's just put Hugh's name in here. This makes Hugh's essays worth writing, worth reading, and a valid part of the upbringing of the upbuilding of the kingdom of God. And then he goes on and says, "This is a consecrated book, even if it's not always correct." And I just like that, because absolutely a life of consecration with Hugh, with all of his gifts, you know, helping us recognize our own gifts, but then putting his into work. And not always did they land, not always did they last as a good idea, but always consecrated, always with Zion at its goal.
Yeah, perfect.
Thanks, my friend. Thanks, listeners. We hope you've enjoyed this series. It's been a pleasure to bring it to you. We hope you'll discover Hugh. I'll try to send links to everything I can to find things for you free online, but also just dig in and read them for yourself, and just catch the delight of the well-turned phrases, the sharp criticism, just always the twinkle. But boy, the guy was bold and just great at heart. So I hope that this has been a prompt to everyone, and we'll just say goodnight. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.